so much, Jonathan, and thank you to Mason Hayes and Curran for bringing us all together today for this seriously interesting conference. It's been really fascinating for me to get a handle on how this incredibly important conversation is playing out in this country. So my background is really as a foreign correspondent. I worked for the FT in South Africa and then in South Korea and then in India. And it was while I was in India that I started to realize that we in the media had been getting this story wrong. We'd been approaching it as a very separate subject from our core topics of what was happening in the economy and business, society and culture. And suddenly I realized, as we heard earlier today from Minister McGrath, this was not the environment minister speaking, although if you'd seen this 10 years ago, you might have assumed it would be. This was the finance minister of this country talking at length about how the climate crisis was top of his priorities. And this is something you see throughout the world these days. Suddenly now, the climate crisis, the energy transition, is front and center of every single story that we at the FT and our competitors cover, the economy, business, and all the rest of it. And yet, when it comes to this subject, it's something that many of us really struggle to grapple with. It's a subject that can feel very overwhelming. It can feel depressing. Often you feel like you're being lectured at or told how your grandchildren will live in a world of fire. There's a huge amount of data and science to get to grips with. But what I realized was that beneath all this are some incredibly powerful human stories and drama. And if there was a way of telling this story, approaching this subject through that lens, it could make it a lot easier for people to get to grips with. So that's what I set out to do with this journey, which, as Jonathan mentioned, took me through 26 different countries on six continents over the course of 2 years. And I met some extraordinary people, from mammoth task hunters in Siberia to clean tech entrepreneurs from Shenzhen to Silicon Valley. An incredibly disparate group of people with incredibly different perspectives, but all of them playing their own different parts in what, to my mind, is simply the biggest story for any journalist of my generation. And I'd like to share just a few of those stories with you today. So when people ask me which of those 26 countries left the biggest impression on me, it's impossible to give an answer, really, but if I'm absolutely forced, I'll always end up saying Mongolia. It's an absolutely incredible country, different in terms of its culture and geography from any other in the world. And I took this photograph of Gombo in Zavkan province in the far northwest of Mongolia. And Gombo is living in this way of life which really has changed very little since the days of Genghis Khan nearly 1,000 years ago. They rely heavily upon their herds of animals. They live in these traditional gur tents. But it's a way of life that is increasingly coming under threat thanks to what they call dzud. And this is one of the most counterintuitive effects of climate change. And it's something which really underscores what an incredibly dangerous and unpredictable game we as humanity are playing with the climate system upon which we all rely. So dzud refers to extremely severe winters. So extremely heavy snowfall, extreme fluctuations in temperature, which results in layers of ice forming over the grass, meaning that animals like this one are unable to break through to the grass beneath and are dying in the hundreds of thousands. Far from Mongolia and northeastern Ethiopia, in the hottest region of the world, I met another group of herders, including Ali Mohammed, who you see here on the left, who live in very difficult conditions, but it's conditions to which they adapted and they've been living there for many centuries, again, relying on their herds of animals. And again, they are now almost entirely reliant on food handouts from the government and from charity due to extended drought and locust infestations, all linked with climate change. In the Solomon Islands, to the far east of Australia in the South Pacific, Gandhi Galagosa here is standing on the site of his old house, which is now being completely inundated by sea level rise, which has been even faster than the global average rate. And this is something which coastal communities all over the world are going to have to get to grips with in years to come. In Bangladesh, Morjina on the right is one of a huge number of people in the southwest of the country who have been forced from their homes due to increasing rates of salinity in the soil, which has been making it impossible to farm rice, which is something which, again, these communities have relied on for many, many years. And I begin with the stories of these communities. The whole book is not in its entirety about the people suffering the impact of climate change, but it's an incredibly important part of it. And I begin with that because it's one of the three key points that I hope to address today. And all three of these points actually might sound obvious, and yet when I go to these COP conferences, there's another one coming up, as you know, in Dubai in November and December, all three of these points seem to me to be underappreciated. And the first of those points is just how urgent this situation is. There are already people who have been losing their lives and their livelihoods in large numbers. This is a crisis that is already well underway. And something you will have noticed about all those people that I just mentioned, well, they have two things in common, really. One, of course, is that they are all among the people in the world most vulnerable to climate change. And the second thing, of course, is that they have really played a minimal role in driving the carbon emissions that are causing the crisis. Per capita carbon emissions in Ethiopia are about 0.1 tons of carbon dioxide per person per year. In the US, it's about 16 tons, 160 times higher. So all of this really comes down to a question of the two words which you'll hear from the mouths of climate activists all over the world and see written on this placard in this photograph: climate justice. And I took this photo of Joanna Sustento, who is a Filipina climate activist, when she was doing a one-woman protest outside the Philippines headquarters of Shell in downtown Manila. And she was taken away by the police and fortunately released later that day without charge. But the reason why she was protesting outside the office of Shell was because Joanna lost almost her entire family to the catastrophe of Typhoon Haiyan in 2013. They were among more than 6,000 people who were killed by that disaster in the Philippine city of Tacloban. And she was protesting outside the office of Shell specifically because in the previous year, Shell had paid out more money in dividends to its shareholders than any other company in the entire world, $20 billion. That was significantly more than Apple, which was in second place. And Shell was able to pay its chief executive, Ben Van Beurden, $62,000 per day. And as Joanna will tell you, the reason why Shell was able to pay such extraordinary amounts of money to its shareholders and its executives was because the cost of the pollution that was caused by the use of Shell's products is not being paid by Shell. It's being paid by people like Joanna's family and many thousands and millions of others in climate vulnerable places all over the world. And so even people like Joanna, even as she's carrying out these protests against specific companies, she's very clear that this is just one part of a wider problem. If Shell were to disappear overnight, that obviously wouldn't make any meaningful improvement to the prospects for the people of Tacloban or anyone else. This is about a change that is needed in the way that the global economy works. We heard earlier from the minister about carbon taxes. To my mind, this is absolutely indispensable. We need to change the incentives that govern economic activity all over the world in order to incentivize a more rapid shift towards cleaner forms of energy. And it's really encouraging to hear, as we heard from the minister earlier today, that this is something which more and more governments are waking up to and are acting to try to shift those incentives. This is a process which is now well underway. We are moving towards a cleaner future. The only question is how quickly we get there. And no one can seriously deny that, not even this man. So this is Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman Al Saud. He's the son of the King of Saudi Arabia, the older brother of Mohammed bin Salman, who, of course, you'll all have heard about, and not necessarily in flattering terms. But Prince Abdulaziz is the energy minister of Saudi Arabia, which makes him the most powerful person in the global energy business. And I requested an interview with him when I was in Saudi Arabia, just because I thought I might as well. And I was amazed to find myself speaking to him in his office for 3 hours. And the reason that happened was because he and his colleagues in the Saudi government are so incredibly eager to get across the following message, which I think we should all treat with a hefty dose of skepticism, but it's an interesting message nonetheless, which is that Saudi Arabia is not a fossil fuel dinosaur. Saudi Arabia is on board with the energy transition. It's going to be a leading power in clean energy, green hydrogen, and many other forms of clean energy. Now, it's not a totally ridiculous proposition, of course. Saudi Arabia has huge potential, notably in solar, as well as good potential in wind. At the same time, however, Prince Abdulaziz was very keen to make clear that they are going to keep on pumping serious amounts of oil for a very long time to come. And they remain a problem in the minds of many people who are going to be pushing for much faster climate action at this year's COP28 in Dubai. But those who defend the decision to host that UN conference in a major oil-producing country point out something which needs to be taken seriously and addressed, which is the need to counter the concerns of those who rely heavily upon fossil fuels and other heavily polluting forms of economic activity. And this is not only rich people like the royal family of Saudi Arabia, it's also people like the population of Latrobe in Victoria in Australia, which for generations saw their substantial coal reserves and the power stations which used that coal to power a large amount of the province of Victoria, they saw this as a perpetual guarantee of prosperity. And now suddenly that guarantee has been cast into doubt. Speaking to the mayor of Latrobe, he was really struggling to get on board with the enthusiasm for the green agenda. He was no climate denier. He was doing his best to attract clean energy jobs to his town. But though the concerns of people like him and the people of his community can't be ignored if this transition is to succeed at scale. So it was important to me not only to talk to the green, cuddly good guys of this story, but also to those who are involved in whatever way in driving the climate crisis. And those people would certainly include Ezio, who I met in the Amazon region of Brazil. I was traveling with an amazing man called Marco Lima, a former soldier in the Brazilian army. And we saw a plume of smoke rising up from the middle of the forest, which we followed, and we encountered this rather scary-looking gentleman called Ezio. And to my amazement, he was incredibly friendly and happy to talk. He was happy to be photographed. He appears in the video that I put on my YouTube channel, which is still available if you're interested. And that was just a sign to me of the level of impunity that has set in the Brazilian Amazon, especially under the rule of Jair Bolsonaro. Now under Lula, who has taken over, we're seeing more encouraging signs, but the problem has reached very severe levels. As people like these two gentlemen will tell you, Awapu and Tebu Uruewawao, who are part of a tribe that was completely uncontacted by the outside world until the 1980s. Now they've been having to fight back against the destruction of their forests by people who are driven by the enormous global market for beef. And this is another side of the climate crisis, which I think gets a decent amount of attention, but needs more. The food that we consume, in particular the meat industry, this is an incredibly powerful driver of deforestation and, of course, of carbon emissions. But this brings me to another part of the story, which I think is something that we should all be getting quite excited about, which is the role of technology, in particular from a new generation of disruptive startups in meeting these challenges. This is a man called Didier Tubia, and he's based in Rehovot in Israel, a tech hub in Israel. And he's building a company, he's the chief executive of a company called Aleph Farms, which is growing beef from cow cells in bioreactors. Now, this is something which probably sounds pretty spooky and disgusting to a lot of people, but he will make a very strong argument that this is the only way in which we're going to be able to meet the world's growing, still rapidly growing demand for tasty meat without destroying the rainforest, casting into doubt the future survival of communities like the Uruwauwau in Brazil. And this is one of a number of incredibly exciting startups I profile in the book, just a few of whom I have time to mention here. Another was in Iceland. I took this photograph with a drone in Hellisheiði, which is a geothermal power plant in Iceland, which is where Edda Aradóttir and her team, she's the chief executive of a company called CarbFix, and together with their partners Climeworks, which is a Zurich-based startup, they have built a system to suck carbon dioxide from the air, not from an industrial smokestack, from the air, and dissolve it in water, pump it underground where it reacts with the Icelandic volcanic bedrock to form limestone. An incredible thing when you think about it. For hundreds of years now, we've been taking solid and liquid fossil fuels from underground, burning them, turning them into atmospheric carbon dioxide that's heating the planet. These guys are putting that into reverse. And they're doing it through these 2 meter cubed aluminium boxes, which have been built by the guys at Climeworks. And when I was speaking to Christoph, who's the co-CEO of Climeworks, I pointed out to him that each of these 2 meter cubed boxes has an annual capacity to remove about 50 tons of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere each year. And global greenhouse gas emissions are 50 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. So to cancel all that out, you'd need a billion of their machines. And Christoph sort of listened politely and said, well, yes, that's true. But then he said something really interesting. He said, Simon, do you realize that we as humanity make nearly 100 million passenger cars every year? And our machines are similar dimensions to a car and a lot simpler and easier to produce. So if we as humanity wanted to build these things at this scale, we could. And I'll never forget that because it showed a completely different way of approaching these questions, which is far more ambitious than we're used to hearing. And it raises the question of whether that is the scale on which we need to be thinking. And it's certainly the scale on which a lot of people in China are thinking. I had a really interesting 2 weeks in that country, in Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Shanghai, Jiangyin, meeting some of the leaders in a new generation of Chinese clean tech startup companies, including He Xiaopeng, who actually became a billionaire through the IT sector. He built China's most popular mobile web browser. He then decided, along with a growing number of brilliant Chinese entrepreneurs, that if you really want to get seriously rich in Xi Jinping's China, the place you actually really want to be is clean tech. This is putting you at the center of the Chinese Communist Party's long-term economic strategy. And it's not first and foremost, as far as I can see, because Xi Jinping is a cuddly green guy. It's because this is clearly the way for China to become the energy superpower of the 21st century, which is a strategy which has been playing out pretty well for them so far. You're now seeing, as we heard earlier, with the Inflation Reduction Act in the US and with other measures in the EU, other major economies scrambling to catch up, but it will be a difficult ask for them. One thing in the US in particular, which made me rate their chances to a decent level, was the cutting edge science that you're seeing rolled out. Bob Mumgard here, a scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, he's actually posing with a fusion reactor from the 1980s. And when it was switched on, this thing contained the hottest point in the entire solar system, 100 million degrees Celsius. That's five times hotter than the center of the sun. The problem is that no one has yet figured out a way to run a fusion reaction that gives off more power than it takes in, which obviously is important if you want to use this for generating enormous amounts of zero carbon energy. Bob, since I first visited him, has raised $2 billion in startup funding. He's now building an enormous prototype fusion reactor in the Massachusetts countryside, which I visited with him last summer, and we were walking around this site. And I suddenly said to him, and of course I'm a skeptical journalist, so I'm by no means buying into his idea that he's gonna get this prototype up and running within the next 3 years or so. But I said, if you do hit your targets, if you do what you're saying you're going to do based on your computer modeling, he's adamant it's going to happen. I said, this is the spot where the age of fusion power will begin for humanity. And he just shrugged and said, yeah, I guess so. So again, this is the level of ambition with which some of these entrepreneurs are thinking. And this is the second key point that I want to get across. It's fashionable sometimes to be cynical about big ideas and skeptical about whether it's worth shooting for the stars in some of these respects. But there's some serious work going on here. And another thing that's interesting to see, a fusion power startup raising $2 billion. This stuff is new. You're now starting to see serious money from serious people flowing into this space. And I think anyone who is not getting excited and paying serious attention to the enormous potential for profit here is missing out on the biggest business opportunity of our time. But I want to finish with a third point, which I think is no less important than the first two. Which stems from my visit to the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I think it's you. I think it picked up your voice. You.
Yeah, that's actually my Siri, who obviously is very well trained. in Kolwezi, which is a town in the southeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is the region that produces most of the world's cobalt, which, as you probably know, is an essential ingredient in most of the world's electric car batteries. And a huge amount of that cobalt is mined in conditions like this. I think I'm the only foreigner who's been stupid enough to go inside an illegal Congolese cobalt mine with Mangovo, whose hand you see in this photo holding a few fragments of cobalt. It was pretty scary just getting down there. It's just a 40-foot vertical drop, which you go down like a Victorian chimney sweep with your bare hands and feet. No safety equipment, obviously. But people like Mangovo spend all day, every day down there. And there have also, sadly, also been children like Letitia, who have been working in these mines. She's fortunately now training to be a seamstress with the help of an amazing NGO called PACT. So when you look at this, there's a easy childish response to stories like this, which you see amazingly frequently, which is to point out some problem with clean energy or with the clean energy supply chain, and you say, throw your hands up and say, well, you see, it's just as bad as the brown energy supply chain, so what's the point? Well, I think that's a rather pathetic response, frankly. The correct response to this is really to take the third point, which really hit home to me during my research, which is how complicated these things are. Sometimes in these conversations at COP, for example, as I mentioned, you'll see a desire to present these issues as though the answers are easy. But it's important to get across the fact that there are no easy answers. This stuff will take a huge amount of hard work. And the amazing opportunity here is the following, that as we are forced by the growing disaster of climate change to move towards a cleaner economy, we have an opportunity to rethink every other aspect of the way in which the modern economy works to build a new model that is not only cleaner, but is truly better in every other way that counts. And I think all of us in this room have an opportunity to contribute to that in one way or another. So let's not waste it. Thank you.
Very good.